This is Limitless Possibility. I'm Yannick Magnan.
And I'm Luc-Olivier Dumeblay.
And our topic this week is...
tips for a good photo trip.
Awesome. But first, we have some follow-up. And of course, I need to start off with a programming note. With the release of episode 222 on February 11th, we're going to go on a brief hiatus as both of us are going to be going on vacation, which is kind of the topic of this episode.
Yes.
So we'll be returning on March 10th with episode 223. Next up in follow-up, there are two bits of Apple news that are a bit too big to cover in follow-up, but we just want to acknowledge them so that you know that we are not forgetting about these topics. The first one, of course, is the Apple Vision Pro launch period, which I don't think we have much to say about. It's that's kind of the discussion to have, really, is how uninteresting the Apple Vision Pro is to us right now at the moment. It feels really weird. It's like the first Apple product in 20 years to be like that for me. So it's strange, but it's certainly a thing that is happening, and we are probably going to hear a lot about it in the coming weeks. So I just wanted to acknowledge that. And then the other bit of news is Apple complying to the European Union. Apple complying to the European Union's Digital Markets Act and making a bunch of concessions in the EU. So this broke today, so I haven't had a ton of time to read up on it, and Lucas has had even less time than I have. But at a high level, it means lowered app store commissions in the EU, alternative browser engines being made available, and alternative app marketplaces being made available only in the European Union and only on iPhones, which is really strange. So there are a bunch of nuances that I think we could explore better in a dedicated episode after we've actually had time to digest all of this information.
Yeah, there's a lot to digest.
Yes, there was more than I was expecting. Let's just say that. Not all of it is good, though, but we'll cover that. Like, we were already planning on doing an episode eventually on whatever sideloading provisions that Apple would have to do back when they were initially sort of threatened to do it earlier last year, and then we didn't hear anything.
Yeah, and I remember you were like, I really wanted to talk about it because I think at that time I had a lot of strong opinion, and you were like, you know what, let's wait to hear more about that. And I think you mentioned that in kind of our limitable planning, I think 6 months ago. So today, while catching up, I was like, oh, Yannick was right. It was a good call to not talk too much about sideloading last year and wait for Apple's move, let's put it this way.
I think I brought it up during the WWDC episode because I was like, where's the sideloading stuff?
Right. Yeah, it's now. And again, I was quickly reading some of the docs earlier and a few hours ago, and I was like, oh yeah, that explains a few things that would have been nice to know at the WWDC, but hey, they're out, not now, but they're at least public now. So
yes.
Expect for more from us on that topic in 2024.
Exactly. Now you can go on with your follow-up.
Good. So for my first item of follow-up is about the whole Threads plus the Fediverse, oh boy, off to a bad start situation. And I think it was maybe a few days after we recorded the last episode that...
Not even. It was when we finished recording, I checked Mastodon and it broke while we were recording.
You're correct. I'm looking at the dates. I have the post open in the calendar. Yeah, it's on January 11th. So yeah, you're correct. And it is a blog post by Tom Coates, if I pronounce their last name correctly, about a meeting before in early December. It's in December, but unclear when exactly that happened, but it was at Meta's offices in San Francisco. We will have a link in the show notes to it. It's pretty long, and I strongly suggest that you read it. But I think the main point I want to bring up is in the section called The Product and the Roadmap. And they've detailed the roadmap for Threads integrating with the Fediverse as follow. Remember, this came out of a meeting that happened in December 2023. So the first item is from December 23. A user will be able to opt in via the Threads app to have their posts quote, visible to Mastodon clients. People will be able to reply and like those posts using their Mastodon client, but those replies and likes will not be visible within the Threads application. Threads user will not be able to follow or see posts published across Mastodon servers or reply to them or like them. The weird part about that first roadmap item is it is marked as December 2023, and it didn't happen as far as I know. And we're late January already.
I'm pretty sure that there is like a VIP group of both Instagram team members, but also just like friends and family of Facebook that have this setting right now. But it's not available to all users.
I see. Okay, next item, named early 2024, in parentheses, part one. The like count on the Threads app would combine the like from Mastodon and Thread users.
This is the least useful feature in the world.
Building on top of that, early 2024, part two. Replies posted on Mastodon servers would be visible in the Threads application. I think that's a pretty useful feature.
Yes.
Why it's not at the top of the list? Again, maybe they want to try with counts. Maybe it's easier. I don't know the exact technical details from ActivityPub and things like that. But hey, they start with likes and then they go to replies. And in late 2024, a quote-unquote mixed Fediverse and Threads experience where you will be able to follow Mastodon user within Threads and reply to them and like them. Meaning that as a Threads user, you can follow your friends on Mastodon. And marked as TBD, full blended interoperability between Threads and Mastodon. So that seems to be a full roadmap for the next year to come. With the caveat that the biggest part of it, which is people on the Mastodon side of things, might have all the functionality at some point, right? This roadmap to me is really for sure thread focus, let's put it this way, or meta focused. But it is divided in an interesting fashion, and I'm not sure where it will leave us in the coming months. As Yannick mentioned, the first part seems to be only right available right now for certain users. And there's not mention of when those features will be deployed for all users in that roadmap and in the rest of the blog post. So interesting to see what will happen. But again, even I read the whole blog post, and it was interesting to see the perspective of Meta at that point, but it was still weird to just figure it out. So I'm eager to see where it will go from here. It seems that we won't get new features for at least the next 6 months, because as Yannick echoed while I mentioned the part one of early 24, the like counts mean nothing, but the reply thing will be pretty interesting.
I think to me the biggest question mark in this entire thing is the fact that it is opt-in only. The more that I thought about it, the more I could come up with plausible excuses why it is opt-in only. Like the first thing that came to mind is, oh, maybe this is a GDPR thing where if you actually want to respect GDPR, you have to do this. I talked to my friend Halsey, who is the administrator of the instance that I'm on, and he still doesn't really understand if it's even legal to have a Fediverse under GDPR. Much less a commercial instance, which is part of the reason why he's very careful not to accept money for donations for his instance. He's like, I want to make sure that this is clearly not a commercial venture, so at least I'm covering my ass if anything happens on that front. So there was the GDPR angle. There's also just the idea that if Facebook, for once in their lifetime, has actually decided to try to do the right thing and play things honestly, maybe it is in their interest to actually force users to opt in to sharing their data with external systems, because they have gotten slapped on the wrist a couple of times in the past because of that. so I can see that being a reason, but if you're just looking at the use case that I was excited for, which is, hey, I want to follow my normie friends without having to use any Facebook software in the process, I can't do that unless I manage to convince them to check a box.
Right. You'll have to force a conversation or a more technical conversation that you would want to have in this world.
Exactly. And I mean, like, some of my friends who are on Threads right now, they're programmers at big tech companies. I think they're going to click the box. But there are other ones who are just like normal moms and dads, and I don't want to bother them with boring technical shit. And it just kind of annoys me that this is the default, but I kind of understand why it's there. It also just makes all of the complaints about federating with Threads seem even dumber if it's on an opt-in basis, because the actual number of users that are going to be reached by this feature is going to be so infinitely tiny that I think we're making a mountain out of a molehill now.
Yeah, especially with the goal of, like, let's remember, Threads and Zuckerberg wants this social network to be a 1 billion user type of social network. So I would for sure expect a percent of a percent of a percent. Am I wrong with math? I don't want to do math right now, but you get the idea. Is the fraction of users that will turn it on will be minimal compared to other features of that. If you're like Yannick and I, and you're a tech nerd, you'll turn it on. And especially all the tech nerd you follow on Threads might just turn it on. But let's put it this way, I follow a lot of people on Instagram that are photographers, and it will be interesting to see if in that market, the adoption rate of that feature when it is available to all users.
The last thing, though, that I want to add with regards to the opt-in nature of it and sort of like the danger of having it be opt-in and only having a tiny amount of users doing it, is that this is not the first time that Facebook has used open technologies, made it opt-in, and then killed that technology by justifying it with, well, nobody checked the box. And that was Jabber support in Facebook Messenger, which was available in the past, and nobody used it except for like me, and then they shut it off. So it really plays into the card of the people who are saying like they're going to use this to like get some positive press, and then they're going to kill it when it stops benefiting them. And there's always a risk that that happens, but I think like playing it this way in particular just sets them up so they can do it really well if they want to do it like that in the future.
Yep, and I'm eager to see what will happen with Threads in the next year. And again, I'm eager to see if there are going to be more posts and just people outspoken about their experience with Meta and how they plan to continue integrating with the Fediverse. This was a great example. I'm not saying that because I agree with all the content that I've read in it, but at least it was refreshing to see somebody being able to speak openly about the meeting at Meta's. Okay, next up, we will need to talk about CarPlay quickly. So in the last episode, we talked about Porsche and Aston Martin demoing the new CarPlay experience at the Mintees 2 years ago at WWDC that is now shipping in certain models. But Ford is here to remind us that there's new way to innovate with CarPlay without using the new CarPlay experience. So a few days back, they've announced their new the next generation of their in-car infotainment system, more or less moving away from QNX to Google/Android Automotive. Based on Android Automotive. So it's not Android Auto, though it does support Android Auto, but it's kind of the quote unquote, I don't think it's a real-time, but it might be a real-time OS. I don't know. But
Google needs some help with naming things. Yes, because it's like the messaging apps and the wallet apps. Android Auto and Android Automotive is the worst possible pair of names. But yes, it is a real-time OS.
Okay, thank you. So it's their own flavor of Android that is also a real-time OS to build in-car infotainment systems. The reason this new experience is being brought up is because, again, If you may remember, the Ford CEO, I think, was at the Code conference, like laughed when they were asked whether they will drop CarPlay support of their Ford cars in response to the GM recent action about CarPlay. And it was funny because they just laughed this question off and say, yeah, we'll never do this. And I guess this shows because the next generation now has support for the dual screen Apple Maps and the whole CarPlay integration. So I have a link in the show notes from 9to5 Mac if you want to see it in action. There is a video and a few images. The whole setup is a bit crazy. Like, it's a big rounded display as the kind of the gauge cluster plus the passenger screen, but there's also a more normal, like, middle of the console, like, infotainment screen. But the idea here is you can see CarPlay information in the middle screen and also in this region that is considered a gauge cluster. This is a feature that I forgot in which version of CarPlay that chip, but it is a few years old. But I'm glad to see that again with a few years of delay that more mainstream car manufacturers are adopting new CarPlay functionality, which not reassures but made me confident that the experience we've seen shipped, or which is about to ship, with Aston Martin and Porsche cars, that maybe in 18 months to years we will see it in more mainstream cars. In that same note, I think the person from 9to5 also asked about the new CarPlay experience, and of course Ford's spokespeople were like silent to say, we don't talk about future stuff. But I'm eager to see how long will Ford take to move to that, or if they will at some point move to that and kind of relinquish this control back to the CarPlay interface. Good, so that's it for my follow-up. Time to move to the main topic. So this week, it is a topical episode because, as Yannick mentioned in our programming notes, it is the second to last episode before our winter hiatus, and both Yannick and I will be going on different trips. So in starting to prepare for said trip, I kind of realized I was thinking about a lot of things regarding to how I want this to be a photo trip or not, which made me think that it would be a great topic to discuss this week about tips for a good photo trip. And I think the first thing I want to talk about is when you decide that you want to go on a vacay and you want to maybe involve some photography related content or production through it, I think it is important to define what type of trip you're about to make. Because depending of whether it's like a fully planned with a lot of activities, or it's a more chill where every day you'll wake up and just figure out what to do, it will impact greatly the type of photography you'll be able to take, and of course the type of gear that you'll bring. So as for my first tip regarding that, it is important to identify, like I said, the type of trip, and for sure who is going to be joining you during that trip. If I take my own trip as an example, it's a week book. We go to the same hotel, we'll stay there, and it's a resort type of trip where we'll be on the resort ground and stay there for the whole week. So in that type of scenario, let's say if I were to bring a lot of equipment, again, I don't have to bring it too much with me on adventures. So I could, in theory, and we'll discuss more how you to make decision on which gear to bring. But I could have some flexibility on bringing maybe more heavy gear and things like that, because again, since I'm not moving too much, not doing too much excursions, it does mean that I can pack everything and ensure it fits in all my luggages, and have all the, I guess, the limits regarding the type of luggages you bring on an airplane. But putting that aside, I could bring a bit more equipment that I really need, because we are not traveling too much during that week. If we contrast that to like a backpack style expedition trip where you need to carry your own luggages for all week, or you're camping for a week, you might not want to bring your big lenses or your big camera bodies with you, because A, it's heavy, B, you're reserving space in your limited luggage space for camera gear, and you might need to fully optimize what you can bring with you. On top of that, I did mention that it is important to understand who will be with you during that trip, because it is important to see whether they'll be A, interested to do some photography with you, or no, or on the contrary, being bored by you doing a lot of photography. You might be in a position where it is okay for you to be the slow person at the back of a group during an excursion, but certain family, friends, like members that are joining you on a trip, they might not like that you are that person doing that on certain excursion. And for sure, if you're traveling alone, or the goal of the trip is, let's say, a safari photo, for sure there will be different expectations that will permit you to enjoy your photography in a different way.
You might actually want to adapt the type of camera that you're using to that scenario as well. If your friends don't want you to have like your huge rig and your giant tripod and your massive camera out, maybe take a point and shoot. If you're going to be spending like 90% of your time together with a group that doesn't want you off on your own taking photos half the time.
Agreed. It will, in my opinion, it will greatly impact the gear you'll bring, and also the type of photography. Like, even if you're going in a nice, like in the middle of the woods where there's not going to be that much light pollution, it might not be the best moment to bring all your like astrophotography gear if you're in a light packing camping type of trip with a bunch of friends that they don't care too much about that.
Yeah.
On the contrary, if you do the same type of light gear camping trip, but you're alone, or you may be with other astrophotographers, then you know you can take the time. So I think it's important, especially when you're traveling with more than one person, to figure this out before you do any type of planning. Like, what is the type of trip? And for sure, who are the people traveling with me? Again, if I use, for example, your trip as an example, Yannick, you're making your own schedule. So the only person you have to argue with on what you do a certain day is with you and you only. So that brings more flexibility than if you're a family with kids and things like that, or just having friends with you. So now that you've figured out what type of trip you want to do and who's going to travel, now we can talk about starting the planning purposes, that is, before we leave for said trip. And throughout the years, I think I've been into two minds. You'll see if you read a lot of like blogs or magazines or whatever, like anything regarding photography and traveling, people are in two camps. There are people that say, oh, you need to either plan photo spots or figure out where you'll be taking photos, and I think it's a good advice. And there are others that say, no, you should just go with the flow and figure it out while you're there. And I think both tips are great, unless you receive the wrong tip, meaning that you're the wrong type of person. If you struggle with the impact of newness, of unfamiliarity, I wouldn't suggest that you just go with the flow. If maybe you thrive in a more kind of street photography style and you like to just be surprised and you thrive in those environments, maybe not going on blogs, looking at what people take as pictures on Instagram about these spots, maybe it's a good idea so that you can bring your own fresh eyes to this new environment without having to plan things ahead. If On the contrary, you want certain types of shot. Maybe it's important to see, okay, I like this mountain. What is available around it for me to park, for me to bring my gear, for me to have a small picnic there to ensure that if I spend the whole day to wait for the right light, that I am prepared and I know the type of scenery that I can see throughout the different spot I'll be enjoying during my trip. Related to that, I bring this up because, again, you might not know. It might be in a few of while since you traveled, or last time you traveled, you might not have been into photography as much as you are right now, or you've changed your style of photography, so that might change. So I think where I land between those two camps is a bit in the gray zone in the middle. I think in the past, personally speaking, I've been unprepared and felt overwhelmed when I came to a new place. I was like, oh, the scene is really nice, but I don't know what to shoot exactly. I don't just want to go on my flash of perspective right now too much because I'm impressed by everything, but I'm not focused on anything at all because everything is so new. Whereas moments where I don't want to dare to say over prepared, but I prepared a lot, kind of felt that I knew everything would happen, so it kind of broke that joy of going to a new place, finding something new a bit. So that's, I think, where I would land, is to say, especially even for if I think about my next trip, is I kind of want to land in the middle. I was like, I don't want to look too much, but I kind of want to be aware about maybe some of the important spots in the city we'll be in. What are the more important attractions that people like to visit, but also kind of leave some time and just some energy to figuring things out there, just so that I have the opportunity to enjoy this feeling of we're discovering a new place and I don't know everything about it, so I can keep my photography eye open to this feeling of newness, which I think is really important for certain tile, for the photography, for the artistic aspect of photography.
I think what's really interesting about like that sort of dichotomy between either like planning meticulously or going in completely, well, not completely blind, but like going into a location with no set plan, is that the more you travel to a certain location, so like the elephant in the room is I've done this Japan trip like what, 8 times, 7 times, I've lost count. Yes. Literally, like I yes. keep going back to Japan. It's basically my second home now. And the thing is, like, one of the things that I disliked about planning too much about photography or just going to areas that are heavily photographed is, for example, let's take Akihabara in Tokyo, which is the electronics, or what was previously more of an electronics neighborhood. So it's like electronics stores, and by that I mean like literally like parts that you would put on circuit boards and stuff, also just anime and video game stuff. Like, it is probably one of the most photographed neighborhoods in Tokyo. Like, I'm pretty sure if it's not the top one, it's like second or third.
I know which neighborhood you're referring to, but I forgot which one that we always see the traditional like big crossing of a lot of people.
That's Shibuya.
Okay.
Yeah. So. Okay. But the same thing could apply to Shibuya as well. It's just like the story I'm telling is about Akihabara.
That's fine.
So when I went in 2012 for the first time, I took basically the same photos as everyone else who has ever been to Akihabara has taken before. And I look back on them today and I'm like, they're fine photos. Like, they're not bad photos, but I just don't feel anything about them because they feel like everybody else's photos. And then in 2019, when I had the new 30mm Sigma lens for my, at the time, the NEX 3, I went back to Akihabara with basically like no plan. I was just wandering around with a friend at night, and I was just snapping photos whenever I saw something that looked good. And I like those photos like infinitely more than the photos that are exactly like everybody else's photos. So I think like instead of planning specific shots, you should plan around go to locations, and then within the location, you should just let magic happen. And I think a certain part of that is only going to come with the experience of essentially shooting the same tourist shots as everybody else, and then being disappointed when you look back and realize that you only shot the same tourist shots that you've already seen a million times. And I mean, like, sometimes there's good that can come from that. So if you're trying to practice a certain type of photography, like, sometimes it's good to mimic a shot that you've seen before, because it allows you to see how you fare in that situation, right? But if you're just taking photos to have the emotions of that photo, and you want to take, like, not on a technical angle, but more on the artistic level, I think you're going to have a lot more fun if you just try taking photos. And some of my favorite photos of Akihabara are some from that night in 2019 when I basically just shot random shit that looked good. And they're not photos that you see all over Flickr and Instagram.
Right. You're making an interesting point. I'll start with where you ended up. I think you're making a good point that you say that my mixed approach to planning just enough on things like that, which is still in progress work, right? I bring this up because I was thinking about that, starting to prepare a few things. And I was like, where do I want to know more about the location, because I've never been, but where do also I want to stop for that and not do too much? Like, okay, I know at the, and what I mean by not too much, but like really prepared, and okay, I'll be using astrophotography, I think not a lot, but for a few examples, but this type of photography, for example, needs a lot of planning. If you want the moon at a certain height in the sky during the night, like, you need to know where you are and things like that. You need to use apps that will tell you, okay, you need to be there, and at that moment during the night, the moon will be this big, or it'll be 37 meters high in the sky and things like that. And that, if that's what you're looking for, totally fine. And that's what I mean. You need to prepare in advance to do that. But for the type of trip, especially the one I'm going to, is it's a mix of where, like, it's what I like to call the typical, like, northern people go down south during the winter because it's cold. And again, it's without going into too much detail, it's the first time Tony and I will do that. So we're kind of seeing if it's something we like or not. But the reason I bring this up is there are a few things, a few exploration, and I want to be aware of, like, oh, there's a nearby city near the resort complex where we'll be, and we want to go visit it. And I want to be aware of not exactly the tourist traps or the tourist attractions, because I think, even if you said the photos are, like, you don't feel anything about it, I think they are important to take. And a few months, maybe even a year or two ago, I was watching a good video from the B&H conference by Scott Kelly about travel photography. And I think, I don't want to misquote him, I think he said take the boring shot, but it might be take the classic shot. But it was part of one of his tips that was like, I focus on details. And I think the example, I think, was in Japan, but it was in a temple. Mm-hmm. And he said the boring shot was to take an architectural photos of the temple. You go, like you mentioned, on Flickr, you see all of these. But then his next shot was focusing on, I think, certain pamphlet with prayers on it. And he was like, the first one is more of a classic architectural travel photography. The one with details has more emotion and things like that. But those two work end in end. So that's why I don't want, like, you were downplaying some of those classic shots. And I don't think they're not important. They might not be your best work, because, as you mentioned, everybody might take those shots. But I think they are important part of travel photography. Like, you want to, it's fine to say, I took a picture, you want to maybe try to find new ways to take those spots. But again, everybody takes photos, whether with all the equipment that exists on Earth, for sure there's somebody that'll have this exact photo. But I think they're important to take and not to downplay.
I'll still take those shots. Like, I'm not saying I don't take those shots. I'm just saying, like, you don't want to overplan and only, like, commit to taking those shots, because I think most of my favorite photos that I've taken in a lot of different locations that are very heavily photographed are when I'm looking at it from an angle that is rarely photographed, and I feel like I'm capturing a moment that I had to be there to get. And maybe that's sort of like teasing me for getting more into street photography, because I feel like I've captured a few of those moments in my last trip in 2019.
Right.
And it sort of gave me the bug, but it's just like there's nothing exciting to take photos of here, so I have to wait to go back to Japan to do it. But like it's your time when you're on vacation to experiment with those things. And you know, if you just see a moment, you're not going to be able to capture it as easily as if it's something happens outside your door, and you probably want to get that shot because it might be something you can never take again.
Right, which brings me to the part of planning a few things. If you have, let's say, a well-organized, like a well-planned, let's say you book a package that says, okay, they will take you from the airport, they will bring you to a hotel, and then you'll do this activity and that activity, and you go lunch here. Like, you see a well-planned schedule, whether it's a package you buy or you do it this way, I think still you should, as somebody who wants to maybe enjoy photography while more or less enjoying a more touristic trip, find spots. And it could be like, oh, 30 minutes here where you disappear and then just wander around in streets and things like that. Or if it's more in nature, like maybe you just wander around to sit on a bench near the top of the hill or the top of a mountain for maybe 20 minutes if your schedule permits. And I think that brings me to what you were saying, is leave places and moments for creativity to spark, right? Because mm-hmm. if you plan too much, you're correct. Again, this is all dependent of the type of trip, right? If we're doing a safari photo, for sure you want maybe a certain shot of animals, especially if we do a typical like animal safari photo, right? You want to make sure you do this. But again, if we're more in the type of trips we're about to do, Yannick and I, which again, they're completely different, but still yeah. in the same vibe of we have time to wander around, I think this is the best way to say, but at least you know where to go wander around or have an idea. And you know what? You might be wrong, and that's fine. And I say that because I also need to practice this, meaning that you plan, you go there, it's not exactly what you wanted, but don't be demotivated by that. Try to find something you didn't know about or something you didn't plan about, part of the mistakes or the misplanning on that, and don't be demotivated because your planning didn't work as planned.
In 2012, when I went to Japan for the first time, one of the days that I was there, I didn't really have any plan at all. So I was like, fuck it. I'm just going to go to every book off used bookstore that I can find. Like, I'm going to go to the closest one. And then from that point, I'm going to Apple Maps to the next one, and then the next one, and then the next one, and I just chained them like that. And then I right. got lost. And then there was a typhoon, and I really had to get back to the place I was staying. So that was an adventure. But during that adventure, I came across neighborhoods that I had never heard of because I was lost in Tokyo, and I got some really good shots that I was not expecting to take because I was just trying to find how the fuck to get back. So sometimes just walking in a direction and just taking photos is not a bad idea. Just make sure that there's not a natural disaster going on while you're doing it.
Right. Or you're, I don't know, it's the off time of a cruise on an island, and you're literally late to get back in the boat and then get to the next island. Like, be mindful of that for sure, but leave time. And I think that's where Yannick and I are both landing, is leave time for those moments, even if you have a well-packed schedule. Speaking of packing, it's that moment where, again, we talk a lot about during the moment, but again, we're still in the before the leaving for your trip section. It's important to think about what you're bringing. Because, as I think you might be aware, as people like Yannick and I are, you might have a lot of gear. And it is important to put the right balance of stuff you bring to enjoy your trip while the gear doesn't become a burden during the trip, right? You're not at home, so you cannot just leave things at home when you're tired, right? You need to be careful where you leave things off, and also about your own energy level to get that gear from place A to place B if you move a lot. I also think that being constrained on your gear is a good creativity creator. Let's put it this way. If you decide to bring a specific camera with only one prime lens, let's take Yannick's example of his 30mm, and you only have that for your whole trip, whether you're in the city, whether you're in the nature side or the countryside, whether you're at the zoo, looking at animals, things like that, it will force you to interpret, to create differently compared to if you add to a few primes and a zoom and things like that.
And ultimately, like, I got the 30mm, yeah, like a few months before I went on the 2019 trip. So it was like a fairly recent purchase, and actually going to Japan with only that lens was a really good way to get used to it, because it was all I had to shoot. I had to learn my way around it. There was no way about it. And
right,
all of that muscle memory is staying with me now, and I'm a better photographer with that lens because of it.
Yeah, with all the upsides and downsides of this expression, like, you had a hammer and everything was a nail. In this case, it made you understand the pros and the cons of that lens and how to use it properly. And in the places that it was not really well suited for, you learn through making mistakes. And that's kind of where this brings, right? You see people that might just bring a point and shoot, or they might just bring, if we talk about film photography, they might just bring reusable disposable camera, the plasticky ones, just to create this while also having the benefit of not bringing too much gear. On the other side, if you decide to bring a lot of gear, you need to be mindful of how you move it around. So you might have to pack more bags or pack more protective gear, which might impact how you move from place A to place B, especially if you have to fly. Be mindful of that. And I think in trips, it's fun to, at home, to have maybe a few cameras, a few lenses. You put them all in a backpack. You don't really care about, you might care about the protective layers in your backpack, but you might be a bit more or a bit less careful. But when you travel, you not only have your cameras and your lenses in your body, you also, your bag, excuse me, you might have other stuff. So be mindful of that. Which brings me to my own, I haven't fully made my decision of what I bring, but I was thinking a lot about that aspect. And that is where I got the inspiration literally for this episode, because I think, was that last weekend? Yeah, it was mainly last weekend. I was thinking about which film I bring. Do I bring a digital body or not? And how cumbersome I want my life to be during that trip with photo gear, for example. And I was reminiscing of my week off over the summer, where we just rented a house here in Quebec, near the St. Lawrence River, but about 5 hours away from home. So it was the whole week, but I did bring a bit more gear than I knew I would need. And not that I regretted it, but the fact that, again, I packed my bag full, I then put it in the car, we drove 5 hours, and then I emptied it when we arrived at the house we rented, meant that I kind of took that as a crutch. Like, I brought a lot of gear that in the end I did not end up using. And for that type of situation, that was fine. But now I'm thinking about that, and because I'm flying, I kind of don't want to be burdened throughout the whole week with that. But if it doesn't change, my idea is as follows. You mentioned point and shoots, Yannick, right? You say, yes, you don't want to be burdened. I'll be using only point and shoots.
Nice.
With an asterisk. So I'll planning to bring a film point and shoot. And then I'm planning to bring my Fuji X100S, which it's not a point and shoot, but it's not an interchangeable lens camera. So I kind of put it in the point and shoot category.
It's a bit of a stretch, but sure.
Yeah, I am totally aware of that. But again, I'm more or less trying to say that because by bringing it a fixed lens camera like the film point and shoot, I am creating constraints, but also I'm will be traveling with small bodies, which is always a great plus.
Mm-hmm.
Have you considered what you're planning to bring?
Yeah, I was thinking about this week. I'm pretty sure I'm going to bring the Alpha 6700 with the 30mm lens.
You're pretty sure? I would be quite disappointed if you don't bring the new camera.
Yes, I'm definitely bringing the new camera. I was pretty sure about the combination of the things that I'm bringing.
Oh, okay, fair.
And then for my... So I think we've addressed it a couple times on the podcast that I'm not satisfied with the iPhone 14 camera. I think it's unacceptable. I think I would rather have the iPhone XR camera. Really don't like it. So basically, since the phone camera is unusable, I'm going to be bringing the Canon PowerShot SD 940IS, which is
nice.
My smaller of the two Ixus-style Canon point-and-shoots that I have. And the main reason for that is that I take a lot of low-light photography, and 800 ISO is so much more satisfying than 400 ISO.
Sure.
And with the image stabilization, like, I've seen what people can do in low-light situations with this camera, so I think, like, there is more of a potential that I can take photos that are more to my liking with this camera than if I brought the other Ixus, which... The weird thing is, the other Ixus I have, which I forgot the number, it's like Ixus 500 or something, I actually prefer how it looks in bright situations, in normal daylight situations. I prefer how it looks to the SD 940, even though like the SD 940 is more megapixels and whatever, it just looks so much better on the older camera, and I'm not too sure why, but that's part of the personality that these point and shoots have that make you choose one over the other. So I use both of them interchangeably, but since I just want to take more low light photography, and I'm feeling more self-conscious about the Alpha 6700 being bigger than the NEX 3 was.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I'm going to be bringing this one along with me.
Yeah, for sure. Those the Ixus are easier to just put in a pocket and are kind of replacing the, oh, it's in my pocket like my phone.
Yeah. Also, I'm going to be bringing, as I usually do, a GorillaPod tripod, a small one that I can put in my bag, because a lot of the times I just like to take it out, put my camera on it, and wrap it around a pole somewhere and take long exposures of night skylines. So hoping to do more of that this year.
Hey, it's a good point you bring this up, because it reminds me that... 95% sure I'll also bring a GoPro, but again, it's rare that I do video stuff. But I did few tries here during the summer of doing time lapses of like, mm-hmm. you know, like a sunset and things like that. So I kind of want to play with that during my trip too. But again, if I bring it and it doesn't end up being used, this is in my category of I don't mind bringing it and not using it, but I will try. Good. Perfect. So now we talked about what to bring, how to plan, it's time to travel. And I think the last point I want to mention before you do so is camera settings, especially on digital bodies. First important thing is before you leave, make sure you know how to set the clock correctly.
Oh, and my God.
Now that you know how to set the clock correctly, especially like daylight saving or not, things like that. And also, is there a clock travel feature? Can you change? Are you required to change the time at destination? Or is there a way to just say, hey, I can have two clocks and just switch it? Or I think my Fuji is this way, is you can, the way you program your travel time is to say, okay, my destination is plus 5 hours my normal time. And then you can just program this. But again, see, I'm already bad with my own tip because I should know. That's why I'm saying you should know how to do that because you will thank me later. You don't want to end up with screwed timestamps on your digital photos because importing then at the end will be messy, especially if you travel with more than one camera. The best example I can give you is traveling with a camera or like any mirrorless point and shoot, and then also using your phone, because for sure your phone will update. Like unless you don't have internet access or even just Wi-Fi access, like the second it will get to internet, boom, you get the right time. Your camera doesn't do that. I haven't had recent enough cameras to know if the apps will do that for you. Let's say
generally if you have a camera that has GPS, it'll do it automatically.
Yeah, but those are rare these days, and they usually rely on these, especially mirrorless cameras, they rely on the app to do the GPS coordinates. So I hope, again, take that with a grain of salt. Maybe Yannick can comment back with the Sony app on the A6700.
I can probably check right now.
if it does time sync too. But important.
I have a follow-up tip, though. Even if you know how to set it, don't forget to set it, because that is my problem.
I know you don't. We're still at before you leave, right? So.
Okay. Well.
So learn how to use it, and then we'll have a few reminders about when to set it accordingly.
Because I'm the kind of guy who notices like a week after this trip has started, like, oh fuck. All my photos are 13 hours off.
Which, okay, I'll skip the during traveling section just for a sec since you bring this up. But at destination, I think the first thing you should do the first time you use your camera is to change it accordingly. And again, you should know how to do that now because you've practiced it at home. But if you're like Yannick, and I don't want to put you too much on the spot, that happened to me too. If you realize the offset, take a note of it. Like Yannick said, like if after a week you realize all the photos you've taken up to that point are 13 hours late or early, take note. Okay, on January 25th, I realized my cameras, so that when you import them, most software, if you correct them and it's like 13 hours, and even if it's like 13 hours, 1 minute and 3 seconds, they'll do the correction for you. And if you select a bunch, I know Photos does that. I know Lightroom does that. If you select a bunch, let's say you select 50 pictures because you took those 50 and you select them all but correct the last one, that's what they will ask you. Either the first one or the last one, depending on the software, and they'll do the offset for all of them. So they'll apply the same offset on all the photos and you'll thank me. So important, if you forget, that was an extra tip at destination. If you forget to change it, take note of the time offset because you can fix it. Funnily enough, I had this conversation with my parents literally last weekend about that. My mom was like, oh yeah, I realize, and then I can just fix it. But she did that one by one, and I told her, oh yeah, if you would have selected all the photos, it would have done it for you, knowing you remember the time offset. Good. During traveling, I don't have that much, but I do have an important note because I've been researching it a lot. Again, with digital bodies, you don't care about going through airport security. But if you bring film, that might be a different problem. We're not in the 70s anymore, in the 60s, where there's no X-rays when you go through airport security. So you have to travel considering that your film will be exposed to X-rays, and film don't light X-rays. So it is a gamble to take, depending on which type of X-ray scanners that the airport you'll be at. As I have a website from Lina Pesonovo, who's an analog photographer from Germany, and she has conducted a great experiment and published her findings on her website and on YouTube. I definitely suggest that you watch the YouTube videos. The link I'll put in the show notes are of our website, where she posts the results, and also have a link to YouTube. But yeah, You now have to be mindful, because if you end up on the wrong type of scanners, you just might end up with no film anymore, because it will have been damaged by the X-rays going through security.
Out of curiosity, does it impact blank film as much as used film?
What's your definition of used film?
Does it damage the film if you have no photos on it versus if you've taken a photo on it?
But not developed it, right?
Yeah.
My understanding is there's no changes, because in both cases, they're still sensitive to light.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Because even if you exposed it, you can still expose it up until you remove the light sensitivity from the silver halides crystal, mm-hmm. which that was development. So yes, you're correct. The most safe way is, from what I've learned, the most safe way is you buy film at destination, you get it developed at destination, and then you're safe, which is less than ideal. But I guess the TLDR, and again, I invite you, because Lena's work is amazing on that front, and she has more fine-grained answers to this. But when you hear that certain scanners destroy completely the film, correct. She has tips on recognizing them. But in most normal, like, top-down X-ray scanners, you can go through it, but the important aspect is try to minimize. So my strategy, for sure, usually what they suggest, I know, again, won't talk too much about TSA because TSA is TSA, but the general recommendation in the US is ask for an handshake of your film rolls, so they don't go through the X-ray, and for sure don't put it in your check luggage, because the X-rays are even worse. And that's what I plan to do in Canada, and then in my destination, because of language barrier and things like that, I might just roll the dice and have them go through the X-ray. Also, again, like I mentioned, I'm gonna be bringing digital and film, so I kind of plan to shoot both and not bring a shit ton of film, since it's going to be my first time traveling with film. I'm kind of using that as my own small experiment. Because again, luckily for you, and it's funny because you'll see in the video, she puts her phone camera up in the scanner, and you see the digital sensor react to being X-rayed while she films. So you do like, start a video, start recording a video, and then put it in the tray and then let it go through. So luckily for us, at least digital sensors are not impacted by X-rays, but still, cameras can still be damaged. So for sure, that's my other tip about the during traveling is make sure you protect your gear correctly. And for sure, for the life of camera gods, don't use checked luggage for anything. Like, you bring your camera with you. I think it's worth mentioning, but still, I think like a laptop, like an iPad, like a tablet, like electronics, you have to bring them with you, mainly for battery reasons. Cameras, for safety reasons, better to bring them with you so that you don't get damaged. Okay, at destination, reminder again, set your clock correctly.
Honestly, I think I'm going to add like a location reminder, so that when I get out of the plane, I remember.
A location, a time reminder, even if it's the wrong time, or put it in the wrong time twice, so if your phone doesn't update correctly, or if it updates too quick, you also have one offset. Like, do whatever, but put yourself reminders. That's a good point. But yeah, clock. You'll thank me later. So, again, those tips, let's apply for film, because with film you have only one copy unless you scan at destination or you develop and scan at destination, but that's not going to be my case. But if you're lucky, then you have two backups. But backups during trips. I never own a camera that has two SD cards, so I always end up with one SD card. And I think, it's a one tip I should have brought up in the before leaving section. I think it is important to buy not only more than one SD card, but buy a bigger SD card that you think you'll need. So if usually you're okay at home and you have, like, let's say, a 64 gig SD card, and it gives you, let's say, 1,000 photos for your own camera, whether you shoot RAW or JPEG, I don't care. Like, you know what SD card size you need for your own shooting habits. Go to the store and buy a 128 or a 256 if you're at 64. Because one of my tips when I travel is, for sure, the typical, have multiple cards. But again, if you have multiple cards, there's more chance to lose them. But I think the best backup you can have is keep the photos in your camera. Then, if you travel with, I think nowadays, these days, your phone at least, like you don't plan to travel with a computer just for the sake of backing photos up, but if you bring your phone or if you bring a tablet just for other purposes, consider bringing with it an SD card reader. Hopefully you have enough storage space on it to just create a temporary backup. And what I mean by that is, even if your photo management process, and we're not going to talk too much about this in this episode, but if your process is on like Lightroom Classic on your Windows PC, like, I'm not saying to do photo management at destination. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying protect your files, meaning that if you can create a backup on your cell phone of either the most important one if you don't have a space, or all of them if you have enough, do that. At least if something happens to your camera or you leave your camera because you forget your camera somewhere, you have a backup. And usually what I've done in previous trips is I do that at night. We come back to the hotel, I plug it in, I let it download everything. I would not, because of my own workflow, I would not import to Photos directly. But in the previous trips, my photo workflow was different, and I would do that right away. So it was kind of already of, oh, it's in Photos. Once I'm back home, it will upload automatically. But at least at destination, I have one copy on the iPad and one copy on the SD card.
Yeah, importantly, like, one thing you forgot to mention is, if you want it to be a true backup, you should leave the photos on the SD card when it asks you what to do with them.
Yes, you're correct, because that was my next sentence.
Okay. Literally.
I was getting there. It's like, I don't have anything else to say, because it's important. Yes, I have something to say. That's why I was bringing it up to, if you're more of a 64 gig users, go double it, because take into consideration that you want to keep a copy there too, so that you really end up with two copies. If you, let's say, like Yannick, where it's a trip where you spent, let's say, weeks at a destination where you know you'll have good internet, hey, if it can be uploaded to a cloud service too, good job. Like, don't let it do the optimized storage and things like that. I think it's going to be important that if you have enough bandwidth or fast internet, or a mix of both, that you keep a copy on this device, whether it's your phone, whether it's your iPad, or any other of those devices, or even a computer. If it's a business trip and the only device you have is your business laptop, hopefully you're okay with having copies of your photos for maybe a week or two, or in their backups. But having multiple copies of your file, even if they're not in your traditional photo management flow, is a must.
Yeah, I got unlucky the first couple of years, and I would wind up like in rooms that had really bad Wi-Fi or no Wi-Fi. Mm-hmm. And more recently, I've had good luck with the Wi-Fi, so like I can finally like watch YouTube videos and upload things to Photos without problem. Whereas right. In the first couple of trips, like one time I was still working on jailbreak tweaks, and I needed to update my phone, and I accidentally restored my phone instead of updating the phone, which is bad, and didn't have a backup. So I lost the first week of Photos on my iPhone. So that sucked. But yeah, be careful.
Yeah, and I will never negate or downplay like iPhonography or like cell phone photography. But Yannick has a point. It's a bit harder to make copies of your photos on your phone, especially if you don't have cloud services available. Again, unlike like desktop computers or more like traditional computer OSs, it's a bit harder to have access to photos. But still, think about that. If you're only bringing your phone and you're planning to use it for your computer needs and your photo needs, that if let's say, even if you're not an Apple user, a Google user, that it might struggle, or you might just be on Cellular and you don't want to bust uploading photos, that you end up with one copy of your photos. The idea behind this tip is don't try to minimize the time where you only have one copy of your photos. And if you're like me and you're shooting film, you have to deal with it. And that's it. Funnily enough, I've seen people on Masson talking about that, and they were like saying, oh, I bring my own chemicals, I develop it then. And
oh, God.
Yeah, I was like, oh boy, that's too much for me. Don't get me wrong. No judgment. You're so cool. Cooler than me if you do that. But I'm not doing that during my trips. I'm not bringing chemicals, nor I'm bringing my scanning equipment.
Even then, you'd have to put the chemicals in the checked luggage because you're not allowed liquids on the airplane.
And the funny part is I've seen people, they just bring the pouches. Like the
oh, well, pouches. Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
And I was like, though, from my understanding of the few posts I've seen, it's usually like people, they go like a month at the destination.
Yeah.
Right, they don't go like for a week at the station and do that. But you know what? If you do that too, that's off for you. Like I am speechless if you do that. But you have my respect.
If you need more arguments to justify a Japan trip, just say there are plenty of camera shops that can develop film over there.
We gotta talk about this offline, by the way. But but thanks for the reminder. We need to talk about this. Okay. For sure, at destination, follow your plan. Don't follow your plan. Be creative. That's fine. Don't stress too much. Don't focus too much about photography. To go back to what we were discussing at the beginning about the type of trip, if it's not the sole purpose of your trip to do photography, be in the moment. Don't be always in your camera too. Try to balance this out. And again, if the whole sole purpose of your trip is a safari photo, like make sure you're on spot with your technique, with your creativity, with the photos you want to do, and then care about the rest. I don't know, work, family, whatever after. But again, if it's a more of a multifaceted trip where you do tourism, you enjoy the nice views, and you also want to take pictures, be mindful of not being in front of your camera and just use your own eyes to look around. So take the time sometimes to just like put the camera down, enjoy, and you might be surprised. You'll go back to what Yannick was saying. You might discover new perspective on the scene you were aware of that you didn't consider during your planning phase.
I do want to offer one last I was about to ask destination. That. Yeah.
Perfect. Go on.
So I'm the kind of sicko who does his photo processing during the trip because that's just the kind of person I am. If I don't do it during the trip, it's going to not get done.
Thank you for the reminder. I forgot that was when I mentioned I wanted to talk about photo management. I wanted to talk exactly about that.
Yeah.
I was about to forget about it.
I recommend like use the SD card adapter or whatever to import into your iPad or whatever. And then my tip for anyone who just wants like to have an album that they can present as soon as they get home of photos that they were taken, my trick is every batch of photos you import, you take 24 of them, the 24 best. Gee, I wonder where that number came from. And you just edit those 24 and then you leave the rest for later. It can be a backlog to process while you're on the plane ride back. If it's a 13-hour flight like me, it can be something you do like in the days after you come back from your trip, or you can just leave it until the far future. I don't really care. But just doing some initial triage and selecting like your best shots or the shots that you want to show to people the most.
Right.
And doing the processing on them and just compiling an album of those batches of 24 shots for each of your shoots is a great way to just have something ready to show to your family when you get back. And in recent years, I've done that every single time, and I think it's been really useful.
It's funny that you bring this up because like I mentioned, I was about to forget about this point, and B, again, like I mentioned, depending on your flow, you might not be able to do that because you're a person that is not like me that always try to ensure that your flow is similar or the same, whether you're in the front of a Mac or in front of an iPad. But I think your general advice of saying at least try to call your photos during your trip, I think is good. Don't spend, like, I think if you do that during your flight, good, but don't, if you have a week trip, like, don't do that too much during the trip. Enjoy your trip and then leave that for after. I do have that problem, and that's kind of my weird transition to once you're back. You're correct. Once you're back, people will ask you, hey, I know you're a photo nerd, or I know you like to take photos. I want to see the photo yesterday. Yeah. I have parents like these. Like this.
Me too.
And they like to remind me that I'm so slow on my photo management / photo post-processing. So, yeah. Be mindful of that. I like your tip of if you take more than a roll of film of photos, even if it's digital, so more than 36 photos, try to wind it down to 24, 36 photos of the day. Or even if you want a bigger challenge, 36 exposure for your whole week, let's say. What are your 36 photos? And maybe leave it at that. So that is for sure. I would suggest some culling drinks or just some triaging, if you want to use the more universal term. But important, if you like Yannick and you do photo management, don't delete. You can take notes. You can don't use the delete feature of your software. Like, you can have a folder of, I would like to delete those photos when I'm home. Do that once you're back. Delete once you're back. Not at
even
home.
Then, I think most people shouldn't delete anything. They should just hide it or like have filters that hide things that were rejected. But I'm a pack rat. I'm going to keep those photos even if they suck.
Right. But I'm talking like, oh, you make a mistake. You snap a photo you were in the bag. Like, don't delete. Don't do any deletion during the trip, because you know what happened. You'll say, oh, I'll just delete this one by accident. You said delete all folder, and then you're like, oh my god, right? So you don't want to, during the trip, don't touch the delete feature. Like, it doesn't exist.
Definitely.
At all, whether it's on the SD card, whether it's on the camera, do that when I'm home. Because my first tips when you're back is ensure that your photos, especially digital, goes through your backup system first. The first thing, no post management. Well, maybe if your backup is part of your photo management workflow, sure. But bare minimum culling, bare minimum triaging, but for sure you do the backup. Because then you can say, oh, I use my 256 iPhone storage and I use the file app, and now I kind of need the free space on my phone because my phone is full, but I don't want to keep those photos on the phone yet. Or you kept the RAWs and you just want a JPEG on your phones. On your phone, you need the space. Do that once you again have two copies of your photos. So leave those operations when you're home. And again, be mindful of trying to do some post-processing fast, because I think it's important for you to enjoy your own photography sooner rather than later. And B, like Yannick mentioned, people will ask you to see your photos, and it sucks for them, and because again, people are excited to see how you enjoy your trip, and this is one way to share your own experience. So people want to see that fast. And again, depending of the type of post-processing person you are, you might need a few days, a few weeks, because you do a lot. Whereas somebody like me, I try to stay light on edits or even like going into full on like photoshopping of photos and things like that. But be mindful that people will ask you this. Again, you're not a professional, if you are, but this is not tips about professional travel trips. It's about personal travel trips. Like, you're not on a deadline, right? If you want to take 6 months, take 6 months. But still, I think you should be mindful of that. Because in the end, you want to enjoy those photos, and you don't want to be stuck on an SD card, nor do you want them to be stuck in your computer. So if you've done your photo, your post-processing of all your photos, or the most important ones, you can put them as backgrounds on your phone, on your devices. You can print them, you can send them to friends, things like that, and it will be great reminders of a great trip you just had. And last tip, once you're back home, don't forget to change your clock back. Because you don't want to be stuck again like that. It's important. Yep. You need to change it thrice. Before you leave, to make sure it's at the right time of home. So your home time. Once you arrive at the destination, to make sure it's at your destination time. And once you come back, to make sure it's at your back to your home time. So that next time you go out with friends or next time you go on a photo adventure here at home, they're not 13 hours late again.
Yeah.
That's that. So I hope that you like those tips about travel photography. And maybe I'm making no promises about me, but maybe once I'm back in a few weeks, you might end up with some photos on Mastodon. No promises. I'm really bad at posting publicly, but still, I could maybe drop a photo or two just to share. But at the same time, if you enjoyed those tips, feel free to send some of those photos that you've did based on those tips on your next few trips. I would greatly enjoy seeing that. So just send me a note to Mastodon and I will really appreciate it.
See, this is the thing, is you're lucky to some degree that you don't have a massive audience of people who are expecting you to post photos in real time of what you're doing. Whereas I have people at work who are very interested in following along with my trip. I have people in the family who are very interested in following along with my trip. Yes. And now that I'm not taking as many phone photos, that means it complicates the sharing story a little bit. I'm going to have to do more stuff in real time than I'm used to.
I have a funny tangent and it's going to be short. So I haven't done in the coming weeks, also do another photography episode that's about like some of the goals I discussed about 2023 and how it ended up happening. And one of them was I had a point and shoot that is an half frame. So I wanted to go through the months and we're in July. I take photos of my nephews and my mom is like, oh, you took photos. Can you send them to me? I'm like, mom, it's going to be in December. And she's like,
yeah.
Oh my fucking God, seriously? December? I'm like, yeah, I'm on this camera is on a process where I'm taking a few photos every month and blah, blah, blah. And then she just gazed off and left.
Yep. Yep.
So, funny story. Also on my trip, my parents are coming to my trip, so they won't ask for photos, but they will ask for photos, but at least they'll be a bit more patient because they'll be in the trip.
They can take their own photos if they want.
Yes, but I think it will leave off some pressure of seeing my own photos too.
Yeah.
I'm sure they'll want, especially my mom, I'm sure she wants to see them, but at least because it's a trip together, it will be a bit easier, or it will relieve some pressure to just say, hey, I want to see a photo while the trip was, blah, blah, blah. So it's like, it's a trip together. So that is it for my topic this week, Nick.
All right. If you want to find the show notes for this episode, you can find them at limitlesspossibility.net/221. You can also find our full back catalog of episodes at limitlesspossibility.net. We are on the Fediverse. The show is at limipo_podcast@mastodon.social. We are also individually on the Fediverse. I am at sakarina@icosahedron.website, and you can find Nicodivier at
luco@mastodon.social.
And we'll see you in 2 weeks.
See you in 2 weeks.